Hello, and welcome back to the History of Australia podcast. As always, before we start, I do want to acknowledge that this podcast is being produced on traditional Kaurna land, and recognise the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region. I also pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future. This week, we're taking a short break from our chronological retelling of Australia's history to focus on a more narrow topic, due to myself being away doing research right now. We'll instead take some time to overview a relatively obscure and often overlooked part of Australia's history, that being our involvement in New Zealand's colonisation and its frontier wars. Now, it isn't surprising that this involvement often gets overlooked, as even our own frontier wars are, with there only recently being support from both the Australian government and the Australian War Memorial for the frontier wars to be recognised within the memorial. Now, the Australians who both affected New Zealand's colonisation and its frontier wars were, for all intents and purposes, still British citizens and likely did not view themselves as anything different. However, the ones we will talk about today would only go on to be involved with New Zealand's colonial history because of their place in Australia's colonial history, either as influential parts of it or as colonists in the region because of it. And therefore, I think it's fair to take the perspective of Australia being involved in New Zealand. Obviously, all of this is inherently connected through the British Empire and its imperial colonies at the time, but this episode will look to take a look at a small snapshot of that, in the men of Australia who got involved. Now, before we get in too deep, I should explain the connection between Australia and New Zealand, which had existed since as long as colonisation had been seriously considered for New South Wales. There is obviously the cases of Abel Tasman and Captain Cook, who are both important figures in Europe's exploration of both places. But even further than that, there is the reality of whaling and sealing in the region. Once New Zealand was known both to Europe and America, that great force of colonisation, that is whaling and sealing, became a reality in New Zealand's waters. And by the 1790s, these sealers and whalers would begin to use Sydney as a launching point for their expeditions. Quite quickly, trade between these Europeans and the Maori became a regular occurrence, with European goods, and even muskets, being traded for flax, food, water, and sex, which is an entire ongoing discussion in New Zealand's historiography. From 1800 onwards, a permanent but fluctuating population of colonists began to exist on the islands, mainly in the Bay of Islands region, as well as around Hokianga. Most of these were men, with the vast majority of these being either sealers and whalers who had come from Australia, or runaway sailors and escaped convicts who were explicitly from New South Wales. There was one other contingent by this early point, the missionaries. They would arrive in 1814, with Samuel Marsden being the first. Marsden is an influential figure in Australia's colonial history, having played a significant role alongside MacArthur, and having arrived in the New South Wales colony back in 1794. His role was especially significant during the turmoil that was present between the Irish Rebellion of 1804 and the Rum Rebellion, alongside being one of the larger landholders on the continent for the time. By 1809, Marsden would be back in England, where he would meet with Ruatara, a Maori chief who had been brought to England on a whaling ship. Ruatara and Marsden would become friends, or at least allies, with Marsden taking the Maori chief back to Australia, Parramatta specifically, before going with him to New Zealand. Marsden's introduction of Ruatara, alongside the other New Zealand sailors and Maori who had visited him in Australia, piqued his interest in the region, and would make him believe that it was worthwhile creating an auxiliary arm of the Church Missionary Society in New South Wales, with the express goal of engaging with the Maori of New Zealand. He and missionaries Thomas Kendall, John King, and William Hall would go over, building the first European houses on the island, as well as bringing over the first horses. Marsden would meet with many influential Maori people during this time, and would hold the first Christian sermon at Ohai Bay on the 25th of December 1814, to a crowd of supposedly a couple hundred. He would go on to start a mission in the same region, though this mission would find little luck after the death of Ruatara, specifically because it lacked his protection. The first major colonisation attempt over New Zealand would occur with the New Zealand Company in 1839. The New Zealand Company had been founded by the colonisation-obsessed Edward Wakefield, who we have discussed at length before. This obviously means that the first colonies of New Zealand were to be founded on Wakefieldian principles, as was the case for Wellington, Whanganui, and the colony of New Plymouth, though this last one was going to be colonised as part of the Plymouth Company, but a merger resulted in it being Wakefieldian. Whatever the case, we can once again see the connection between Australia and New Zealand's colonisation, with this one entirely explicit on the back of Wakefield. Wakefield, having seen the failures of the South Australian colony at this point, and the issues the New Zealand Company would have with absentee ownership, would also create the Canterbury Association, designed on Wakefieldian principles, which had been tuned over the years. This was not a large success, though then again, most of Wakefield's colonies weren't, and if they were, it seemed that they were in spite of him, as the majority of potential buyers did not want to buy the land in person as the Canterbury Association required. Nonetheless, it does once again show that connect between the two colonies, especially considering many of the squatters in New South Wales who did have shares in the New Zealand Company. Through this period, New Zealand was in a middle spot as to who specifically led the colonists on the island. However, as the New Zealand Company began to colonise, the Colonial Office would move to expand New South Wales territory to cover all of New Zealand, making Governor Gipps the Governor of New Zealand also. In this case, Australia's influence over New Zealand's colonisation is clear here, though this was quite limited. It was just after this that the Treaty of Waitangi would be signed, and while I won't get into all of it, as that's for a New Zealand history podcast, it is suffice to say that this treaty was, and is still quite controversial. Whatever the case, New Zealand would be separated from New South Wales in 1841, with William Hobson being the first governor. While him and the second governor, Robert Fitzroy, hold little connection to Australia, the third one, in 1845, would be Governor George Grey, the ex-governor of South Australia. Using the knowledge he had gained during his time in South Australia, especially in regards to the colony's interaction with Australia's indigenous people, he would push for the reduction of land ownership and rights for the Maori, and an increase in cultural assimilation. While conflict had been extant prior to Grey's arrival, such as with the Rauru affray, the events known as the New Zealand Wars would begin as he arrived, with the start of the Flagstaff or Northern War. Called as such due to taking place on the Northern Island, and because its immediate cause was Honeheke cutting down the Flagstaff, which carried the Union Jack in the region. During this time, the amount of troops on New Zealand was incredibly low, and Imperial troops were needed elsewhere in what was becoming a violent conflict. The Maori, having quickly and widely adopted muskets into their warfare, and fighting from fortified villages known as pas, were seen by the British as a conventional military threat. Believing New South Wales to be safe for the time being, Secretary of State Earl Grey would order Governor Fitzroy to send 900 troops to New Zealand for the ongoing conflict. By the 1860s, over 3,500 troops had been moved from the Australian colonies over to New Zealand for the wars, especially in regards to the First Taranaki War, where a majority of these troops, as well as the HMVS Victoria, the Victorian colony's first and only warship, fought. The actions of the HMVS Victoria, especially, are Australia's first military actions overseas, when we consider that by 1860, Victoria was self-governing, and that the Royal Australian Navy views the war as its first official battle honour. However, these are examples where the line between Australian colonial and British imperial asset are blurred. The next example, though, is perhaps far less blurred. Having been removed from the governorship in 1853, Grey would be returned to the role in 1861, and war would begin once again in earnest with the start of the invasion of Waikato in 1863. It is here where Australia made its greatest contribution in manpower, war material, and supplies for New Zealand's wars. Men from Australia's colonies, which were self-governing by that point, volunteered for the war in droves, and would join the New Zealand colonial militias. The Taranaki military settlers, for instance, had over 550 men enlisted from both Victoria and South Australia. Australians were also present through all four of the Waikato military settler regiments, mostly from New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania, with likely 2,500 plus men volunteering for the war overall. These were Australian colonists, many of whom had been born in Australia and who recognised themselves as part of a colony that, while still very much British, that had its own level of autonomy. Most of them went over on their own regard, though some were sent as part of movements or small groups. At the same time, the Royal Navy also recruited from Australia's population to help fight the war, and the Australian colonies would also work to limit the export of ammunition and arms to the Maori from both Australia and America. These would come in both warning New Zealand if shipments were incoming so they could be stopped, and straight up prohibiting the sale of warlike stores to the Maori, such as with South Australia in August 1863. In more than one way, the New Zealand Wars of the middle 1860s were Australia's first, though small, genuine involvement in a war outside of its own territory. Even if you ignore the earlier involvement as British imperial connections, these here do demonstrate something deeper. This is furthered, at least symbolically, by the fact that Australia had correspondence from its newspapers, such as the Argus and the Sydney Morning Herald, reporting back to the colonies about the war. This is important, as prior to this war, all the news Australia got was from New Zealand correspondence or reports, whereas now, reporters from Australia were directly sent to witness and report on the war, with this being the first time that such an event would occur. Their reports would contain detailed accounts of the fighting in the region, including of the 50th Regiment, which had been stationed in Australia from 1834 until 1841, and which many of those reading would have recognised the name of. These reporters also gave their insights into the Maori situation at the time. These insights do contain significant levels of racial superiority in them, and so are not the most factual, but they do provide us with clear insight into how the British and the Australian colonists viewed the Maori people and their war. The views of these correspondents were often higher towards the Maori than they were to the Indigenous Australians, likely due to the Maori having a conventional sort of civilization, at least relatively, when compared to the Indigenous Australians. And it is likely that these views were shared throughout Australia. This minisode is one I've been interested in doing since I undertook a comparative history class, which compared the colonization of Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. I am not a New Zealand historian, nor trained in their colonial or Maori history, so I did not feel like it was my place to discuss their history too in depth. Instead, I wanted to use this minisode to expand the knowledge of Australia's involvement in New Zealand's history, and how their frontier wars became our country's first experience with war outside of its own continent. From missionaries and governors to Australian-born volunteers, Australia's military history is intertwined with New Zealand's, far before even the Anzacs. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge that. Next week, we're back to our regularly scheduled programming. We'll discuss the disappearance of explorer Ludwig Leidhardt, something which I didn't know about prior to the podcast, but I'm super excited to discuss now, and the ongoing conflict between landholder and squatter, as well as the start of the push for Victoria's separation from New South Wales. Will these political squabbles continue to weigh down the Australian colonies, or will the colonists finally figure out conversation and compromise?